This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, the poetry and prose of everyday folk. Writer, editor, teacher, and former Chicago Tribune columnist Robert Wolf. He is our guest. 10 years ago, Wolf began a series of writing workshops across the U.S. He met storytellers from every walk of life. People homeless in Nashville, farmers in the Midwest, and people living on and along the Mississippi River and in the Delta. Poetry and prose from those workshops are now available in the book An American Mosaic, and we can expect more in the future. An American Mosaic is a work in progress. Robert Wolf is at work listening to the voices of Chicago, the Southwest, and suburban Connecticut. This afternoon, we'll talk with Robert Wolf about the people he's met and what they have to say. As we talk, I hope you'll join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you can hear us, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Robert Wolf has taught in public and private schools. He now runs private seminars and workshops. He's the co-founder of Free River Press, a press dedicated to documenting the contemporary American scene. He's the author of Crazyology, Autobiography of a Chicago Jazz Man, and Story Jazz, A History of Chicago Jazz Styles. He's the editor of several collections of prose and poetry. An American Mosaic is published by Oxford University Press. Do join us with your questions and comments, 333-WILL. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Robert Wolf, good afternoon. Welcome. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I'm fine as well. You were quite young when you decided to strike out on your own to look for what it is that makes us who we are. Where did you go, and how did you search for what it is that makes America, America?
Well, I was 16 when I ran away from home. I'd asked my parents all that summer let me hitchhike out to my grandparents' home in Ohio. I lived in Connecticut. They didn't want me to do it, but I had been reading novels of Kerouac and Sandburg's autobiography, Always the Young Strangers, and I just did it. I took a train into New York City and proceeded to hitchhike out to Ohio. And I had quite a few. I got drunk for the first time in my life. In fact, I picked up by a couple of truck drivers driving out to West Virginia, and just met various characters. In fact, one of them was the guy who designed the guidance system for the Polaris missile. It was interesting. And that really was the first of many hitchhiking trips throughout the country. And from then, I just went on to trains and work in many different areas of the country. My goal had been, since I was stimulated by Sandburg and Kerouac and Dos Passos and others, to really understand every section of the country. I wanted to work all over, to live in virtually every town in the country, to work every possible job I could, to have conversations with people of all types. And I did things like, when I think I was 19 years old, I went out to a little tiny town, Durand, New Mexico. I think there were 65 people there at the time. It was on the edge of the state plains, and I rented a little shack without heat for $10 a month and stayed there for February and March of one winter. And the adventures just continued. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked on a ranch off and on for 4.5 years out in New Mexico later on, and taught in an inner-city Brooklyn school, and was a surveyor in Connecticut, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and a house parent at a home for retarded people. So I purposely, you know, sought out many different experiences to just try to get a handle on the country.
Yeah. What's your idea of home? What does home mean to you?
Well, it's more than just a place. As I began thinking about this whole question, working with the homeless, it began to mean to me a settled place within the cosmos. That is, I think we're symbol-making creatures. Maybe that's above all what we are. And we've stripped ourselves of so many of these symbols that, that our ancestors had. I mean, they had a picture of the universe which was bounded by a, you know, a crystalline sphere, and the stars were on that, and the planets were within that. And we've pretty much we've demolished that, and we argue as to what the shape of the universe is. We don't feel that we are purposeful creations. I think the majority opinion is that we are accidents of nature. And for all these reasons, not having any fixed place within the cosmos and being accidents of nature, we are not at home. And I think that this is a great part of the alienation that besets us, and a great reason for so much of the violence and the unease that with which we're surrounded.
We've been diminished.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Why don't we dig right into some of the voices?
Okay.
And since we've been talking about home, maybe it would be appropriate to go to the section of the book where we hear the voices of some folks who were, maybe still remain, homeless when you were in Nashville.
Okay.
It's interesting, this is a group drawn to poetry.
Yes, I think it's because a lot of them were Southerners, and they came from an oral tradition, and the tradition has a strong storytelling tradition, but it's also a tradition has them in which they write their stories in song. I mean, they're sort of almost automatically drawn to lyrics as a way of expressing the story. And so that's why I collected a large amount of poetry from the homeless,
yeah.
Of course, in Nashville, as you said.
And how did the Nashville workshops begin?
Well, I was married in December 88. My wife and I immediately went down to Nashville. She's a singer, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I wanted to do some kind of social service work. And I had done adult education before, and I decided that's what I really wanted to do. So I called up the Nashville Board of Education and asked for some work, and they said, well, all they had was GED, had a couple of GED classes for homeless men and women, and I jumped at that chance. But I was warned that most of these people had high school diplomas or GED certificates, even college degrees, and so I was just going to have to improvise until I got students who needed tutoring. This was, by the way, they assigned me to a shelter down in downtown Nashville, and this was a transient population that would be down there for 2 months at a time. A person could stay down there for up to 2 months. And what I did was I began talking with the men about how they became homeless, and then my wife said, just get them to write it down, and that's what I did. We did this to people, some professional artists, people of different backgrounds were coming in, and we had a core of about nine people, homeless and non-homeless, who worked together for probably about six or so months. But the workshop itself went on for about 2.5 years. And after the first month of writings, we held a public reading down in Nashville. We had the standing room only crowd.
Mm-hmm.
The Nashville press was very, very supportive and gave us good articles and a lot of support.
Yeah. What kind of reaction did you get from community leaders outside of the press and the folks who would come for?
Oh, it was again very supportive. The mayor of Nashville sent me a letter when he read an article in the paper on the workshop, and he said it was people like you who make Nashville a good place to live. That was typical of the reaction. It was very supportive.
Yeah. Well, what would you like to share with us? Do you have the book with you?
Yeah, I'd like to read a poem by Robert Roberg. Robert was a Mennonite street preacher. At the time he joined the workshop, he was not homeless. He had been homeless with his family before, but he was being paid by the Mennonites to preach the gospel on the streets. and he would illustrate his paintings with his sermons with Day-Glow paintings. He's a self-taught primitive artist. And now his stuff is, when he does sell it, they sell it about $2,000 a piece, and there one of his paintings is in the American Museum of Folk Art in New York. This poem is called Dressed in Doubt.
Mm.
I, the pilgrim, dressed in doubt, set out one morning to see God. And I didn't see him in any of the rich new churches where the people dress like movie stars, nor in the dusty tomb-cold cathedrals, the last place he'd be seen dead in, nor in the womb-warm roll-in-the-aisle joints. I didn't see him in the trees at Mission Park. I didn't see him in the green sky or blue grass, nor in the faces of babies or the laughter of children. I saw God in a night alley behind a Chinese restaurant, digging through the trash, with wild, hungry, flaming eyes and wondrously crippled hands.
These poems are really, they're really important.
I think so, yes, yeah. I mean, what Robert is saying here is just what the Gospels tell us, is that you're supposed to treat, the poorest one as Jesus. I mean, the person you might meet on the street, that beggar just might be Jesus.
Yeah. Would you read Well Seasoned, a poem by L. Gilbert?
Yes, and L. was an executive secretary in New York. She was secretary to the famous John Hammond, who was a producer of black music, blues, and jazz, and a very, very important man in American music. And when he died, L., her real name is Liz, came to Nashville to duplicate her career, and she couldn't.
And she was homeless?
Yeah, she was homeless for a while. Friday night, Nashville, Captain D's fish chain on West End Avenue, where the elite meet to crunch, chomp, guzzle, and slurp, unaware of the perpetual draft from the air conditioner or the monotony of Muzak in the distance. Counter girls appear at intervals to wipe off tables, fill napkin holders, keep the ketchup flowing and the customers content. That's what they're paid to do. So when they holler, "Y'all come back," in their best finishing school voices, don't take it personally. You're not a person, first of all. You're a seafood platter and a Coke, or black coffee and a banana tart. Nothing more. Don't forget that. Hush. Be quiet. Eat your grub as quickly as possible and get out. These are the unspoken rules of the restaurant game in these parts. No room for poachers or poets, just as no dogs allowed.
Hmm.
She spent most of her days in a McDonald's restaurant on West End Avenue in Nashville, and she wrote. What she did most of the time was simply observe the life about her and write it down. So a lot of her poems appear as almost just notes, as it were. I mean, it's some real trenchant stuff in there.
Yeah. You know, one of the themes that comes across in the book, both in the work that the writers and the poets of everyday people comes through, and in your commentaries and essays, is that work, like humanity, seems to be a diminishing force.
Yeah.
Work is a means of making money,
right?
And not a human endeavor necessary for our
full existence,
full being.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, traditional societies recognize the fact that work, which is and work, you know, as I make the distinction between work and labor, work is imbued with art. And labor is work stripped of art. And that's what we have done. We have, in this industrialized and post-industrial society, we have taken the art out of work, and we've transposed, made most people into laborers, including a lot of executives. I mean, there's very little the satisfaction of the person who crafted furniture or jewelry. We buy the mass produced And in housing, I mean, housing is a great example here. There's very little housing that is built with art. I mean, it's all prefab, pre-designed. They're using cheap materials. Even these very expensive houses have very cheap materials, and it's just all put up, bang, bang, bang. They know exactly how they're going to do it. And there's no love. Work calls for love. If you have a calling for something, a vocation, then you love your work, and you do it despite the sufferings or the lack of money that you might get from your work. But I think if a person is true to himself or herself, he or she recognizes what her aptitude is, which is what her love is, and she follows it. And there are very few people who do that today. I find also that there's a lack of courage in this society, a lack of integrity. That is, I mean, if somebody... I truly think, I guess, in some deep sense, that if a person is not following his calling, that in some sense they're lacking integrity, if that is, if they know what the calling is and they fail to follow through on it.
Hmm.
I mean, I've seen a lot of people, including, you know, very highly paid business executives who would much rather be doing something than the rat race, and they are really, they have a strong urge to do something. I know one, for example, who makes Windsor rockers in his spare time. He would rather be doing this for a living. He's gone and taken courses in this from master, you know, mm-hmm. chair makers. But he doesn't have the courage to quit his job. And so he goes on doing public relations and hating every minute of it and making money, but always quitting his job one step ahead of the axe, getting fired.
Hmm. What does it take to get hold of some courage? It's really tough. I think we've become accustomed to being a seafood platter in a Coke.
Right. We've gotten very passive. And it's in part because we expect the experts. We're a society of experts, and the experts are going to make the decisions and make things right for us. But secretly, we know that the experts really don't know what the hell they're talking about either, and that they're just lousing things up further. It just seems like things are totally out of control. And I guess maybe people are simply opting for safety. Yeah, things have become so unpredictable. Everything is changing so rapidly that they just hang on to what little they do have, the lousy job that they do have, even if it does make them $100,000 a year or whatever.
Mm. Is this really a contemporary problem, or... you know, is this something that's been with us for a long, long time, part of the human condition?
I think that this is, I mean, you can go back in time and you can look at societies where, you know, people were mistreated, but I think in traditional societies you don't have this problem. I mean, this is a problem created by industrialization, by the fact that we began sometime around the Enlightenment to divide up the world into little boxes, areas of concern that would be treated and handled by various experts, various kinds of scientists or economists or what have you. I think it's through industrialization, really, that we lost work, we lost art, and we became, for the most part, laborers.
Do regional voices remain strong, or have we seen a smoothing out there?
We're seeing a smoothing out. As you know from reading the book, my big concern now is to help to encourage regional voices. I want to help midwife into being more regional literature. Because I see a lot of stuff coming out of New York houses, even though it might be written by a person from a particular ethnic group in a certain section of the country. When it comes out, when it finally comes out of the New York publishing house, for the most part, it's pretty much sanitized. When I look at contemporary fiction, I don't hear real voices. I don't hear the voice of ranchers or the voice of businessmen. I hear some kind of homogenized voice coming across, and I'm searching for it. In fact, I'm doing a book on writing right now, and I'm looking at this question right now, because I think that the fact that we don't have, I mean, if you go back in our history, go back to the 19th century, we had all kinds of regional voices in American literature. And even into the early part of this century, writers were working in dialect. There's very little dialect writing, for example, that's going on now. But there was a lot of it at the time of Ringelardner and before. So I think this contributes also to the dehumanization of the society. Somehow the person is disappearing. Well, in many ways, the person is disappearing, but this is just one of the ways. So I'm also using these works to help develop regional theaters. I think community theater is more important than ever now. And I don't think community theaters, for example, should be working or presenting Neil Simon plays or stuff that comes out of New York. They should be working with local writers to produce plays about their area, dealing with their problems.
Yeah, you say every town should have a writing workshop.
That's right. That's right. I believe that they're stabilizing. They help preserve the local culture. And they can help develop a vision. I mean, I've done this kind of work. I wanted to use the techniques of the writing workshops to actually begin doing economic development up here in Northeast Iowa. And I got three local colleges up here to subsidize a program. I got six school districts involved because I'd heard if you can get kids involved in economic development, it's easier to get the adults involved. So we did a tabloid-sized book that we gave away. We had adults writing to and also some college classes. I won't go into the details of the book, but it dealt with, also we had an assessment, a survey of community assets and needs or regional assets and needs. But we used the writing workshops to help create a regional consciousness. I want all of my books now to help develop that regional consciousness because without that, we can't begin working cooperatively. And I find that contemporary culture is very fragmenting.
Yeah.
It keeps us apart. And I want to use this workshop and the books to help bring people together.
I think this would be a great point to read an excerpt from an essay in the book by a young man by the name of Patrick Kipp.
Oh, okay.
Page 175, I have written down, jotted down.
Yeah.
And tell us how you met this young fella.
Well, I met Patrick through this project, the Regional Economic Development Project. He was in one of the school districts that had signed on to the program. And I wanted the youngsters to, one of the things I wanted some of the youngsters to address was the flight of youth from rural America. Because it had to be something that the adults had to face quite squarely. And they had to know why the kids were leaving and had to acknowledge it because in rural America, especially in the Midwest, there's a tendency to sort of push or brush problems under the rug and try to just forget them. So that was the intent of this one. What would you like me to read from here?
Well, I don't know. We can probably do the whole piece. I mean, it's not very long.
Okay.
And it's called Where Do You Want to Be?
Some of the better-known television commercials are those made by credit card companies, mostly most notably Visa. These advertisements always show some attractive vacation spot, ritzy restaurant, or location that appeals to different special interest enthusiasts. You will never see Northeast Iowa on one of these commercials. One can almost imagine the introduction of such a commercial if it did exist. There's a place in the Midwest where there's, well, a lot of farms, and, well, that's about it. But hey, you might need to stop for gas or something, so be sure to bring your Visa card. Depressing, isn't it? However, in many ways, it is the truth, especially in the eyes of the local youth. Northeast Iowa has been described as the most depressed part of the state. This is evident in the job opportunities, values, entertainments, and allure of the region. First, let's talk about jobs. You can be a farmer, a factory worker, a nurse, or a tradesman of some sort, and that's about it. Almost everything is blue-collar or pink-collar. There are very few openings for jobs that require college or university training. The few jobs that do require it are usually taken. Therefore, there is little reason why any college student would be attracted to the region. Then there is the matter of things for young people to do. football games, beer parties, and circling the high school with their cars are the local favorites. These activities are also about the only option, other than bowling or going to the movies. In the line of entertainment, Northeast Iowa leaves much to be desired. For the youth of the region, it is often like growing up inside a gigantic bubble that separates you from the outside world, a world where exciting things happen. The term Dullsville might come to mind. There are no YMCAs, no discotheques, no big-name concerts. Boy and Girl Scouts are the best Northeast Iowa has to offer in the line of youth organizations. Other legal kinds of entertainment include high school sporting events, which are typical of the rural U.S. When those things don't suit your fancy, you can always rev your car engine or squeal your tires as you circle the school block. And there are drinking parties. In Northeast Iowa, adolescent boys prove that they are men by determining how much noise they can make with their vehicles and how many beers they can down at a party. Other than that, the only entertainment that Northeast Iowa youths have are the kinds that they create with their imagination. The subject of entertainment brings up another aspect of Northeast Iowa values. This region is, without a doubt, primarily a conservative one. Few people want drastic changes. Many are against extensive government control. Many take conservative stances in areas such as religion, sex, and gender roles. In addition to this, a sizable number of the people in this white-dominated area take more conservative stances on the issue of race. The conservative value system is further evident in the types of activities this region is willing to support. The people of Northeast Iowa in general are very willing to support athletics, but are reluctant to support the arts. They will eagerly donate to the building of a new football field or baseball diamond, but will scream and holler about helping the art club get more paint or brushes. They will cheer for a star quarterback, but not for an all-state speech contestant. The high school band just doesn't capture the public eye the way the high school basketball team does. Children and teens share this attitude. Elementary students don't care what your favorite painting or play is. They want to know which NFL team you like the best. And among the most popular items of clothing for local adolescents are T-shirts that say, "Such and such a sport is life." Obviously, the next Ernest Hemingway or Gertrude Stein will not seek to reside in Northeast Iowa for inspiration. The final major thing that Northeast Iowa lacks is allure. Young people want excitement, nightlife, things the big city has to offer. Chicago has the Museum of Science and Industry. Northeast Iowa has the Vesterheim Norwegian American Museum. Seattle has its well-known rock music scene. Northeast Iowa offers polka and folk music. Hollywood easily outshines this region. Furthermore, young people want to shop in Chicago's Magnificent Mile, not in Norby's Farm and Fleet. And Northeast Iowa doesn't have any nightclubs, just restaurants and taverns. All in all, Northeast Iowa is not a youth magnet due to the factors of employment, entertainment value, and allure factors. It's Hicksville, Clodhopper Central, Old Timer Heaven, Square Capital of the World, and so on. This region is not a place for young people looking for excitement, opportunity, and success. It's a backcountry bubble, a depressed farming region that will never be seen on a credit card commercial.
Hmm. What did you think after you read this piece?
For the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Just was echoing what I'd already been hearing from the youngsters. So it didn't come as a surprise. It's something that's just repeatedly said. It's said again and again. And unfortunately, up here, because the kids have nothing to do, and because of the mentality he's talking about, we have a lot of kids dying in alcohol-created car accidents. It's a very high death rate up here.
Hmm.
We just had five more youngsters die in a car wreck just a couple of weeks ago.
So how does an area like Northeast Iowa try to address the situation?
Well, for example, if it was a fact of drinking, they're not doing anything. We had one local minister who brought it up, and he has gotten together with other ministers, and they're going to just go for some kind of a grant and do some kind of school education, but other than that, nothing. And they really, because we have a very, very high population, I think, you know, most of our, I don't know what the proportion is, but we have a very high proportion of very elderly people here. You know, probably most people are at least over 50, if not over 60. And so they're not concerned with, you know, the arts. They're not interested in getting, you know, a theater group going. Or bringing in, you know, a traveling concert or something. It's until there's actually an influx of people from Chicago or St. Paul, and that's happening. I mean, very slowly, they're moving west from Chicago into Wisconsin, and it's spilling over into here and down south from St. Paul.
Looking for a good place to live.
Exactly. And until the balance shifts in favor of the younger urbanites who are used to more cultural amenities, is not much that's going to change here.
Yeah.
But I think that's true of West Tennessee or almost any other rural area I've been to. I mean, I spend now a fair amount of time down south, and in particular in West Tennessee, just north of Memphis, and change the accents down there, and you'd have northeast Iowa. I mean, the attitudes are the same, the politics are the same. It's very, very similar.
Yeah. It seems that some towns, though, are faring better than others.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think in some cases, I'm thinking of around here, there's one town out here that has a good college, and of course that helps a lot. That is a magnet for other people who are more arts-minded, more intellectual. Other than that, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm talking this afternoon with Robert Wolf. We're talking with him about a collection of prose and poetry that he has put together called An American Mosaic, Prose and Poetry by Everyday Folk. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you can hear us, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Lots of folks are pretty good storytellers, but when it comes to writing it down, I imagine most of us are pretty shy. How have you gotten folks to tell you their stories and to write them down?
Right. If they're hesitant, I tell them that anyone who can tell a story can write one down. And that's been pretty much the case. I've only had a few people who've come to a workshop who've actually not written anything. And within the last year, I've been telling them, see, what we do is we sit around a table, and there'll be anywhere from usually 8 to 20 people, and we'll start off by reading a published work, some stories that Free River Press has done, and talking about what made them work. And then everyone will tell a story. Now, I must say that usually there's something that binds the people at the table together. Maybe they're all members of the same community, or they're all homeless, or they're all farmers. They share a common interest. And once they start, everyone is going to tell a story that they would like to write. And other people ask them questions about it, things they want to know more about. And as people are going around the table telling stories, it stimulates a lot of other thoughts in other minds, and maybe somebody changes their story. There's almost a real dynamic, almost an electricity that goes back and forth across the table that gets people excited. And they're reaffirming one another. And they can relate to one another's stories. After probably about a half hour to 45 minutes of storytelling, maybe longer, then I'll tell them, now we're going to write. And write it as closely as you can to the way you told it. That is, almost try to go word for word, because many people are very good oral tellers.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to writing, they lose all the tricks that they had. I mean, we haven't gone to school to learn rhetorical devices, but somehow we know, we use them. We have all kinds of devices that we use when we tell the story. And what I'm trying to do is to have them, use the same kind of subtlety in their writing that they have in the speech. And it doesn't always come out that way, but it sure helps. I mean, we get some pretty wonderful stuff. And every after, say, 45 minutes of writing, then we go around the table and everyone reads his piece, and the others will comment on it. They can't make any negative comments, but they say what they would like to know more about. Or they'll say, you said such and such in the telling, but you didn't put it into the writing. I'd like to see it included in the writing. And we'll work usually from, say, 9 in the morning till 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon, and we'll repeat this whole process that I've described. We'll repeat it 2 and 3 times, or at least 3 times during the course of the day. And I'll usually, a full workshop in the community will be 3 days, and they'll oftentimes finish that essay on the second day and begin a new one. In some cases, they'll have all 3 days to work on the essay and polish it up.
And do these folks keep writing after the workshop is over?
A number of them do. In fact, 2 people started writing professionally after these workshops. There was one woman who was a sales clerk in Independence, Iowa. She came to the workshop down there. The local newspaper editor was with her, was down there participating, and asked...
Good afternoon. This is a terrific program. I want to be sure, Robert Wolf was?
Yes.
W-O-L-F?
Yes.
Okay. An American Mosaic is the title?
Yes, it is.
Well, sir, you're doing a great job. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, just wonderful to think that somebody is pounding on a nail that ought to be driven in the barn instead of just making noise. Now, these workshops you mentioned, how are they put together? They cost money, I assume.
Yeah, what I do is I go into a community and I'll look for a sponsoring organization. Because I personally don't charge for the workshops, but I'll get a sponsoring organization to pay me. And then they make whatever arrangements they want to. Usually the organization doesn't charge the individuals. I don't think any organization has. Sometimes it's a community club or a state agency has done it.
What are the workshops called?
Well, I just call them writing workshops.
That's all?
Yeah.
Have you talked with high school students?
Yes, I've run workshops with high school students. I've worked with, in fact, with at-risk youth this past year. I've worked with 3 or 4 times in conjunction with my wife. We do go in and we'll do a week's worth of work with youngsters, and we'll have them make handmade books. She works with them on the art, and I work with them on the text. And I've also worked with elementary age students. We've done a book called Let's Pretend.
Well, I just think it's fantastic. One of the things that's true, and the little story that you read from one of the people about the credit card advertisements always showing beautiful people at beautiful locations, eating fabulous food,
yeah,
and wonderful music in the background, and all of that kind of thing. Obviously, that's not going to be true where the young people are growing up.
Right.
Now, are we seeing a lot of movement of young people to other places because of this?
Because they find their own place boring?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Aha.
Yeah.
Well, is it comparable to the changes that were wrought in the United States with the loss of the agrarian, or are we still in that stage where the farms are big conglomerates or something, and the family farm where all the people there had to know how to do practically everything from
right.
taking care of the chickens and pigs to fixing the car. So all this is changing.
Yes, disappearing very rapidly.
And our government is not helping.
No, the government appears to be on the side of the large corporations.
Uh-huh. So somebody ought to write the organization man again and tell the truth about it, right?
They should. In fact, I'm doing a series of three articles on the industrialization of agriculture for the North American Review. And the first of them I just finished. It's on genetically engineered foods. Most people would be astounded to know how much the extent to which their food is genetically engineered. But I guess the point is that the government is, the USDA is backing this stuff. They're saying that the stuff is safe. I mean, in the antitrust division of the Department of Justice gave the green light to Cargill's acquisition of Continental's grain operations. And these were two of the largest grain handlers in the country, and Cargill just absorbed Continental. Now, that's up for a review by a judge, but, as far as the government's concerned, its agencies are concerned, this is the way to go. Big is better.
Well, we're here drawing down on our time really rapidly. We've only got a minute or two left. I want to thank the caller for her call this afternoon. She raised a lot of interesting points, and I'm sure that she'll enjoy reading An American Mosaic, because I think that the voices from the Midwest will, I think she'll really enjoy hearing those voices that you bring us in An American Mosaic. Before we go, maybe you would read one more.
Okay.
From rural America, the Midwest. Mike Finnegan is the storyteller, is a retired hog farmer, and it's a short piece. He's remembering a man by the name of Burkhard Riegel.
Oh, yes. What page?
That page is page 160.
Okay. Burkhard Riegel is a legend. I remembered well when I started farming in the late 50s. Riegel did many repair jobs for me, and if there wasn't a clear plan or method on the tip of his tongue, he would say, "Let me think about it." Everyone was always amazed at Burkhardt's method of bookkeeping. His system was immediate and accurate. He would often charge for his services with what seemed to me very little hesitation. Anything from a nickel for a small job to a dollar for a big job. Dad would ask, "How much today, Riegel?" "Oh, give me 35 cents. Dad would hand him a dollar. Burkhardt's hands would go into action, the quarter in one pocket, nickels and dimes in another. His bib overalls held the bills. Never examining or eyeballing the change, he would complete the transaction fast, and we would be on our way. Burkhardt never liked to be bothered when he was busy at something, and he worked very early in the morning and late at night when farmers didn't come in to bother him. If he was deeply taken up with his work, he often refused to look up when a farmer walked in to pick up his fixed piece. The finished jobs would be neatly stacked against the right wall as you walked in, and Burkhardt would quickly look up and nod in the direction of your fixed piece, and you were on your way, knowing your bill was scribbled on some sort of crude but accurate account record."
Hmm.
Yeah, that was a blacksmith in Claremont, Iowa, that Mike is writing about.
Yeah. Not too many folks around who work like this.
No.
Anymore. No. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, Phyllis, for having me.
Robert Wolf has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Look for his book, An American Mosaic, Prose and Poetry by Everyday Folk. Robert is the editor of this collection, and the book also contains some commentary from him, some essays of his. And we look forward to hearing more American voices. Robert Wolf is currently at work on listening to the voices of Chicago, the Southwest, and suburban Connecticut. So look for a larger work, a larger